image is striking. A man in the shadow of the spotlights, hunched over the piano, gently and intuitively coaxing sounds out of the keyboard. It's nearly impossible to see where his shape ends and the piano begins, almost as if he were one with his instrument. To see and hear Bill Evans leaves a lasting impression.
He'd sink down toward the keyboard, and I never quite knew why. And I didn't know whether he was trying to get his ears right into the piano to be in closer communication with it. He would, and his head would be down and turn slightly to the left, which means away from the audience. I think it was a way of maybe shutting himself up in concentration.
The way he touched the piano is something I miss right now. To have that kind of support when he played behind a solo, it was just the most loving way of being sent out there and being presented. It was so wonderful. It was a solo in a way. I mean, it was complete there. It was just so beautiful, so tender. So I miss that a lot. I'm not just being supported, but I miss the way that we knew things together, and the way that I knew that his art was something I always want to reach for.
I've spent many, many hours listening to Bill in person, also on record and CD and everything. So his playing to me, I would say it's the clarity and the level of sensitivity and musicality that stand out to me most in Bill's playing.
He really believed in his art and his place in it. And yeah, I think he had a very clear picture of who he was in relation to the totality of the art of jazz.
He is, quite simply, one of the most important pianists in recent history. He influenced many in his short but brimming career. He led innovative jazz trios, helping to extend and reshape the role of the piano, bass, and drums. As a proficient and sensitive improviser, he could embellish, caress, and give fresh meaning to the compositions of others. And his own compositions, while few in number, have a quality that's everlasting. I'm Nancy Wilson, on this edition of Jazz Profiles, the music of Bill Evans. There are many facets to Bill Evans worth celebrating, but the most notable may be the sound he gets from his instrument, unmistakably his own and unique for its underlying melancholy and crystal clear tone.
His sound, I think, is very special. And I think it just had to do with everything he heard and just his being in general. He was his humanity, he just heard that.
Eddie Gomez, Bill Evans bassist.
How he did it, I think it's maybe a pianistic question is how you prod that kind of gorgeous crystal kind of sound out of an instrument like the piano.
Bassist Mark Johnson.
It's a really warm, fluid kind of playing. And it's so clear. His statements are wonderfully clear. There's like no wasted motion, no wasted notes. there's still something, there's the essence of Bill that comes through. Probably a person who doesn't know anything about music but can sense, they know what Bill sounds like. They hear his chord voicings, the way he moves, the inner lines, the inner voices, and just the kind of tunes that he plays tend to have the essence of beauty. I don't know how else to describe it.
Jazz author and critic Gene Lees.
I brought home a record one day, a CD, when we were first making CDs of Chet Baker. And I stuck it on, and I heard one chord at the beginning, and I said, my God, that's Bill. I never knew he recorded with Chet Baker. So one chord, and I knew who it was.
Bill Evans.
I never said, like, I want to have an identity in so many words. What I said was, I want to build my music from the bottom up, piece by piece, and kind of put it together according to my own way of organizing things. Yet I want it to fit in, and I just have a reason that I arrived at myself for every note I play. I think having one's own sound, in a sense, is the most fundamental kind of identity in music. But it's a very touchy thing how one arrives at that. It has to be something that comes from inside, and it's a long-term process.
Danny Boy, from the Complete Riverside Recordings, Bill Evans solo piano, recorded in 1962. That long-term process, that development of personality, began in Plainfield, New Jersey, where William John Evans was born, August 16, 1929. Right from the start, Bill was fascinated by the piano. He would eavesdrop on his older brother's piano lessons. And when his brother was done, Bill would sit at the keyboard, reciting the lessons he had overheard. But it was his parents who contributed to that budding personality, according to Helen Keane, Bill's longtime producer and manager.
She was Russian, and his father was Welsh, and somehow that combination seems to... it also has a lot to do with the melancholy side of Bill, but certainly the musical side.
By the time he was six, Bill was taking his own lessons, demonstrating, even then, an uncanny ability to read music. In fact, he would sit for hours at a stretch playing through hundreds of pages of sheet music his mother had collected for Bill and his brother.
My first teacher who brought me into music and got me to read music and therefore developed a great ability to explore music through a superior sight-reading ability without bringing the whip down as far as a type of approach to music like the scales and arpeggios and heavy technical work, which would have, with my temperament at that age, turned me against music.
It didn't seem to matter what kind of music it was. He absorbed it all. He also absorbed it listening to the phonograph, which led to his interest in classical music.
I can remember, for instance, the 78 album of Petrushka, which I got, you know, early on in high school as a Christmas present, a requested Christmas present, you know, and, you know, just about wearing it out, you know, learning it. And that was a kind of music that I, at that time I hadn't been exposed to, and it just, you know, was a tremendous experience to get into that piece.
Pursuing their interest in music together, the Evans brothers attended Southeastern Louisiana University. Bill's brother Harry graduated and remained in Louisiana to teach music. He would remain an important influence in Bill's musical development. Bill, on the other hand, spent much of his time honing his skills as a musician, playing jazz clubs at night. Bill left Louisiana for a brief stint in the Army, then in 1955 enrolled as a composition major at Mann's College of Music in New York City. The scene in Manhattan proved to be an eye-opener. He encountered a new generation of pianists, his generation, who were exploring new ideas and musical concepts. Bud Powell, Horace Silver, Lenny Tristano, and George Shearing. Horace Silver's Senior Blues with Horace Silver on piano, from The Best of Horace Silver, recorded in 1956. Attentive, absorbing, and constantly experimenting, Bill borrowed many of the ideas he heard and fashioned them into his own. His individuality and distinctiveness began emerging, and others began to take notice, including a friend from Louisiana, guitarist Mundell Lowe, who introduced Bill to producer Orrin Keepnews of the Riverside record label. Keepnews sensed immediately that Evans possessed something special.
There was a quality there. There was something that was interesting and intriguing, and I can't tell you what it was, really, but it made me feel, hey, this is somebody that I'm interested in. So I got to hear Bill as much as I could, and that cemented my feeling that this was an interesting, imaginative, intelligent player, and somebody that I felt impelled to deal with.
Firmly dedicated to having Bill record for the Riverside label, Orrin Keepnews gave Evans his first recording date as a leader. The album was called New Jazz Conceptions, and one of its tunes was an Evans original, Displacement. Bill Evans from his first recording on the Riverside label in 1956, with Teddy Kochik on bass, Paul Motion drums. Making this recording for Orrin Keepnews put Bill in a serious quandary. He had always enjoyed classical music as well as jazz, and he played both exceptionally well. But the question was, should he drop one and spend full time on the other?
I went through a lot of mental pains and anguish about choosing, and realized that where I functioned was where I should be, and where I functioned was in jazz, so that was it.
Shortly thereafter, Bill Evans received a phone call that would reaffirm his preference for jazz. The call came from Miles Davis.
Finally, one day in 1958, Miles was on the other end of the phone asking me to make a weekend in Philadelphia, which was a thrill to me. I felt that band was perhaps, and still do feel, it was perhaps the greatest jazz band ever was. And when I made the weekend in Philadelphia, he asked me to join the band, and that's the tenure that I had with Miles at that time.
So What from the session Kinda Blue, featuring Bill Evans on piano, Miles Davis on trumpet, and a cast of other musicians who would go on to make their own marks in jazz: Julian Cannonball Adderley, John Coltrane, Paul Chambers, and Jimmy Cobb. In the years following, Kinda Blue not only became one of the all-time classic recordings in jazz, but a benchmark for future generations of players. In a 1971 interview at Ronnie Scott's Club in London, Bill was asked if his musical ideas had an influence on Miles Davis and the Kinda Blue session. Evans replied in what came to be recognized as his usual humble style.
It may have been that he found a sympathetic ally in me for something that was lying latent in himself. With my presence there as a pianist, which directed sort of, you know, a flavor of what's happening, he knew that we would be able to create this thing.
Gene Lees.
Bill contributed enormously to that album. First of all, Blue and Green is Bill's tune. It's got Miles' name on it, but it's Bill's. He contributed all of that wonderful balladic sonority, and also Bill was very interested in that kind of modal playing that Miles was interested in.
Blue in Green, with Miles Davis on trumpet, Bill Evans on piano, and John Coltrane on tenor saxophone. The Kinda Blue recording put Bill Evans squarely in the spotlight. And for the shy young man from Plainfield, New Jersey, the notoriety proved to be too much too soon.
Bill told me that it was the acclamation that he got because of the Miles Davis sessions that in some ways got him into drugs. To be held in the class with all these great musicians that he so admired, the pressure he felt was tremendous. Clearly, this was something dark within him, terribly dark. It comes out in the music, and it came out in the way he conducted his life.
Evans' drug abuse presented an escalating need for money and led to his departure from Riverside Records. Orrin Keep News.
It finally escalated to a point where another label was extremely interested in acquiring his services, and we finally made arrangements to terminate our contract, to let him go elsewhere. And so in that sense, yes, his addiction eventually ended our relationship.
Unlike so many drug addicts, Bill was meticulous about paying back every cent he ever borrowed. It's almost as if he toyed with his addiction. writer and friend Gene Lees, who at one point roomed with Evans.
Don't forget, Bill didn't get into dope as a kid. Bill was 28 years old before he ever tried it, and he knew what he was getting into. I don't think Bill ever wanted to quit. And once he got off heroin, and it was a period when he was on methadone, and then that period went into cocaine.
You're listening to a tribute to pianist Bill Evans on NPR's Jazz Profiles. I'm Nancy Wilson. With the added public exposure from the Miles Davis Band, a new level of respect from audiences and fellow musicians, Bill Evans was now in position to realize a dream.
I always wanted a trio. That was my basic ambition. What I do now is exactly what I wanted to do, and going with Miles seemed to maybe intimidate the jazz public and the critics enough so that they would at least lean in and consider me.
The idea of insistently being a trio player is a fairly aggressive thing for a piano player, and I think that perhaps argues that beneath that mild-mannered, bespectacled Clark Kent exterior, there was more of a self-aware Superman than we might have realized.
Evans' concept for a trio set it apart from all others. He wanted to give greater roles to the bass and drums, to provide ample space for musical conversations to develop between and among the individual voices, pianist Andy Laverne.
Certainly the first trio with Scott LaFaro and Paul Motion has got to be right at the top of the list of any piano trio. It's pretty much the template for piano trio playing since then.
That is one of the most significant trios in all jazz. This is the one where he finally found people who could completely follow him in a totally loose give-and-take conversation away, rather than the pianos being accompanied by the rhythm section. Scott LaFaro was one of the revolutionary bassists in history. He had this blazing technique and a lyrical melodic sense.
When we got together, I realized that Scott had the conceptual potential, he had the virtuosity, and he had the experience and the musical responsibility and so forth to handle the problem of approaching the bass function in jazz, especially with a trio, which is a very pure kind of setup, with more freedom. Just really accepted a conceptual goal, which was more conversational, more a thing where, including the drums, where everybody could contribute. They didn't have to play the roles that were more or less assigned by jazz tradition, but rather leave our minds wide open, but with responsibility, so that we weren't just going off into space, that we were using that tradition, but allowing ourselves to be a little bit more open within it.
Thank you. The Miles Davis composition, Nardis, featuring Scott LaFaro bass, Paul Motion drums, and Bill Evans on piano, recorded in 1961. Even though his trios were characterized by their openness and equality, the musical center was Bill Evans. He knew exactly where to put the notes, not only inspiring the others, but propelling them. Eddie Gomez.
The way Bill voiced in his left hand and right hand, he didn't cover up the same function that that the bass would carry. As if you hear other pianists, you'll hear a lot of doubling. Bill didn't do this. He left a lot of room there in the left hand, and then generally in his voicings, kind of this kind of airier kind of voicing, that allowed for a bass player to touch on a root or another part of the chord, or actually be kind of involve himself in a kind of dialogue. So kind of stylistically, from the early days when I first started hearing Bill, from the early trios with Scott LaFaro and Paul Motion, this was part of the intrigue and sheer joy of the music for me as a bass player and just as a musician, to hear this kind of counterpoint going on.
Drummer Paul Motion.
The way Bill played behind other soloists, like, for instance, the bass, Ben, I mean, he just knew where to place those chords, you know? They're just exactly right. And it just sort of propels the music and lifts the music. I mean, he was a master at that. And I learned a lot from that. And I sort of would do the same thing, you know? I mean, I would play and try to make the music as exciting as possible by my dynamics or my accents or whatever.
Jack the Jeanette made the point to me once, he being both a pianist and a drummer. He says, Bill not only changed the approach to piano, he changed the approach to trios, and it affected everybody. He's unquestionably the most influential pianist since Bud Powell.
All of you, from the Village Vanguard sessions with Paul Motion drums, Bill Evans piano, and Scott LaFaro bass, recorded in 1961. The trio and its new approach received high praise from audiences, musicians, and critics alike, but the trio was short-lived. Soon after that recording at the Vanguard in 1961, Scott LaFaro was killed in a tragic auto accident. Evans was devastated. He lost a friend, an alter ego, and a musical soulmate. He brooded for months and even stopped playing. In time, Evans returned to the trio format, first finding bassist Chuck Israels, then eventually landing on Eddie Gomez.
Insisted that you not do anything necessarily in the traditional way. He wanted that kind of contribution. He didn't verbalize it that much. I think one of the reasons that he might have been attracted towards my playing, even as raw as it was when he first heard me play, was that I so it might have exhibited some of that kind of tendency to want to kind of move a little bit more or not be quite so traditionally minded in the bass role.
Eddie Gomez on bass, Bill Evans on piano. You Must Believe in Spring, recorded in 1977. Eddie worked with Bill for 11 years, but in 1977 moved on to lead his own groups. Determined to stick with the trio, Bill found new ideas and renewed vigor in bassist Mark Johnson and drummer Joe LaBarbera.
To tell you the truth, this very trio I have now, I feel some kind of a continuum with that original trio. I don't know why or what, but I just feel like it is almost a connection, as if there was nothing in between. I like this trio very much, and it stimulates me. It's making me feel fresher than I have felt, I think, since that time.
Pianist Warren Bernhardt, who lists Bill Evans as one of his most important influences.
He was being very stiff for a while. I'm not criticizing, this was my gut feeling when I'd go to hear him. Tempos were rushing and he was playing this, like playing mechanically. And then later he broke out of it when he got together with Joe LaBarbera and Mark. It was back to everything was scintillating again. And he said so. He said, man, I don't know where I feel like Rip Van Winkle. I've been, for years I've been playing and playing and playing. nothing's been happening, and now every molecule in the room, it was down to Vanguard. He said, did you think that every molecule in the room was vibrating to this music? He was overjoyed.
Bassist Mark Johnson.
My most fond memories of listening to Bill Evans records when I was 17, 18, 19, 20, with the Scott LaFaro and Bill Evans trio, you know, that era from the 59 to 61. And I wanted to embody that the essence of that trio as much as possible.
Turn out the stars with Bill Evans on piano, Mark Johnson on bass, and Joe LaBarbera on drums. Just ahead, the trio is taken to a new level. Three pianos, all played simultaneously by Bill Evans. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is Jazz Profiles, a tribute to Bill Evans from NPR, National Public Radio. Throughout his career, Bill Evans seldom rehearsed. He preferred the spontaneity that developed among musicians on stage. Rehearsal, he felt, dampened the improvisational process. But Evans never lost that old childhood ability to sight read. He certainly surprised pianist George Shearing.
Bill Evans came to my house in New Jersey in the 50s. And I have in my library right now a Schumann quintet, which is a string quartet with the piano part missing. I put the record on, and there were two clicks, and then the strings started to play. And Bill started to play and read through that thing as if he'd been playing it for forever.
Pianist George Shearing.
And he has that wonderful background. I mean, he's not an unschooled musician in any sense of the word. And we talked about complexity of rhythm. And he would leave me dead once in a while by getting so involved in crossing over from one bar to another that I was almost tempted to say, where's one? But he would go ahead and scientifically explain it.
George Shearing may have marveled at Bill's firm grasp of musical concepts, but for Warren Bernhardt, it was the flawless technique and unwavering concentration that made Evans' piano so memorable.
Well, he was very thorough. And he had, I don't know where he got the tremendous command of the piano except through diligent work. He had a better command of the keyboard than anybody I've ever seen. I mean, everybody always said, oh, Bill Evans, piece, ballads, you know. But, man, you'd hear him practicing My Bells or a tune like that and B, or I remember he was working on, at that time, Make Someone Happy. And he tried it in all the keys, you know, before he decided on the key of A, which is a very difficult key for the tune. For hours and hours, I mean, for days, he'd be playing that tune. That's all he would focus on.
Bill Evans and Make Someone Happy, recorded in 1966 at New York City's Town Hall. Evans always strove for perfection, and he believed the greatest artistic achievement began with a firm foundation.
I think of music very much architecturally, very much as lines and structures, and that's always been my way. And yet I like to bring into that a lyrical element or a human element. But I think that the real strength of music is in its architecture. And no matter how much human feeling you put into something, if it's architecturally weak, it's going to be weak, you know, regardless. And if it's strong architecturally and you add the human feeling, it's just that much heavier.
That blend of architecture and human feeling is what makes Evans' music so lasting. You can hear it in his Waltz for Debbie and Peace Piece, which have become standards in the jazz repertoire. But he could also bring it to the compositions of others. In fact, Bill may long be remembered for his reshaping of other works more so than his own. He could breathe new life into well-known pieces like Love Theme from Spartacus and Someday My Prince Will Come and make them his own. It was a direct result of his musical conceptions, improvisational prowess, and deep respect for the American popular song.
I respect the American popular song very much and some of the masters that have composed in that form. And it became a means for jazz players to improvise by using a lot of these forms and songs to play off of. And I studied this very hard and analytically and diligently as I was growing, and got deeply enough into it so that I feel it's worthwhile to continue working with it, because there's still explorations that I haven't begun to make yet.
Someday My Prince Will Come, performed by the Bill Evans Trio in 1959, with Scott LaFaro on bass and Paul Motion on drums. I'm Nancy Wilson, and you're listening to the music of Bill Evans on NPR's Jazz Profiles. Throughout his career, Bill performed publicly because he had to. It proved to be lucrative, and it was essential for keeping the trio together. But what he really loved was playing at home, where he could spend hours entertaining himself with new ideas and approaches. He was also comfortable taking his experiments into the recording studio.
Yeah, I enjoy it. It's just a nice thing to go in the studio and do that kind of thing. It's an enjoyable challenge, and it enables me to use larger conceptions texturally and you know, contrapuntally in every way than I ordinarily can.
In 1963, Evans decided to experiment with an unusual way of recording. He went into the studio and taped 2 to 3 different versions of melody and accompaniment for each tune. As he added layers of music, he was listening to what he had previously recorded, embellishing and contrasting as he played along. Evan said, "I feel that the music here has more the quality of a trio than a solo effort." But this recording technique was more difficult than he ever imagined. Critic Gene Lees, Verve Records producer Creed Taylor, and Bill's manager, Helen Keane, were there.
But we all just kept hanging in with him, Creed and Gene and I. And we went so far as to turn all the lights in the studio and control room off in one session. But he was in the dark, finally, and couldn't see anybody. And we tried everything. And then finally, when it began to come out, then it was just not smooth sailing. But it, of course, got the Grammy that year, and then he did another one for Warner Brothers later on.
Round Midnight, from Conversations with Myself. Bill Evans playing three pianos for which he received a Grammy Award in 1963. The influence of Bill Evans runs very deep in modern jazz. His stylings, concepts, and approach have touched new generations of players. But Bill, always one to downplay his influence, saw it all as a part of the jazz continuum.
I could see where I could be influenced because I think what I've done is I put something together which is not eccentric, and it's something that somebody can pass through also. They could become influenced by it, and it's not so highly stylized, I think. At least that's the way I see it.
Helen Keane.
He was a very modest man, and he acknowledged that in the most modest way because this question was asked him all the time. And he would say, "I feel very grateful having achieved the position I now have." Now, that's a direct quote. It was something he couldn't verbalize. I think it was a very emotional thing for him. So he never allowed any interviewer to question him too much about it.
Pianist Andy Laverne.
The big answer is he's influenced everybody that has come after him. But to be more specific in terms of piano players, certainly all the big influences today were influenced by Bill. In other words, Trick Corea, McCoy Tyner, Keith Jarrett, Herbie Hancock. None of those players would be playing what they're playing today if it hadn't been for Bill. And they all acknowledge that as well.
Years of physical abuse finally took the life of Bill Evans in 1980. Far too early in his career. He was only 51. But he is still firmly embedded in the jazz world today for his innovative ideas, his influence on musicians in all types of music, and through his many outstanding and unforgettable recordings. Bill is sorely missed, but he will continue to be around for a long time to come, pleasing old fans, generating new ones, and leaving that lasting impression.
And I went down to Toronto, and we were on the air. It was a live interview. And
they played Waltz for Debbie with the lyrics. And all of a sudden it hit me, and I started to cry right on the air. And it's when it really came over me. It was bothering me something awful.
Emotionally, he moved me a great deal. He still does. Bill dug in very deep into my heart. His love for music and his warmth, you know, as a person, as a musician. It's touched everybody that's ever really listened to him. You know? That's what I hope that we don't lose. I'm sure all of the people that were really affected by that will carry that with them, you know, into other lifetimes and everything.
It's kind of deep in a way for me because my father was so into Bill, and I, in a way, it was an extension of respect and love for my father that drew me to the music to begin with.
Gee, I don't know. I still dream about playing with Bill. Not always in a good way. That was a growing up period for me. So sometimes they're almost uncomfortable dreams. Like, I wonder if will we still love each other, or sometimes the dreams are, I know we still love each other, and I think we do.
And we can only hope that he rests in the peace that he gave us in his music.
Our tribute to Bill Evans was produced by Beth Schenker, post-production engineer Chuck Thompson. Thanks to Dick Bush, Wayne Instis, Joan Merrill, and John Jeremy for providing some of our interviews. Special thanks to Steve Robinson and Nebraska Public Radio. Jazz Profiles is produced by Tim Owens. Assistant producer is Madeline Smith. The executive producers are Mary Beth Kirshner and Murray Horwitz. To email us, or for more information about this and other programs in our series, contact us through NPR's homepage on the World Wide Web at npr.org. That's npr.org. Major support for Jazz Profiles comes from the Lila Wallace Reader's Digest Fund, helping people to make the arts part of their everyday lives. Additional support has been provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Nancy Wilson, and this is NPR, National Public Radio.